frightened. It was exactly noon. Let me hear it. Shan held her phone up to her wall. She had described the sound perfectly. Typing. There was nothing else I could think of when I heard it. But the typing noise stopped in a matter of seconds. It was exactly noon. 10 hours into the end of the world. Nobody knew anything about it. Haggled.
I will pay $5 for the snow globe from Iowa City, this corkscrew, and the porcelain corn cob salt and pepper shakers.
Mom, the drum major at the head of the tourist parade, placed her spoils on top of the counter beside my cigarettes. The two-headed boy with four arms and legs pressed its noses against the face of the glass case and left dual unpointed exclamation marks in clear snot directly in front of the bug collections. Dad, at the rear, slid his hand down into his purse and extracted a billfold. Johnny McKeon haggled with customers. Price tags, in stores such as From Attic to Cellar, may just as well have been written as fill-in-the-blank forms as far as most shoppers were concerned. Johnny knew what to do. I did not. I said again.
Well?
She asked. She thought I was stupid. I knew the look.
$5.
I'm only taking care of the counter for my girlfriend's dad, I said. I suddenly felt virile, capable of breeding, horny. The twins frightened me, though. Their noses pointed upward on the glass, distorting into two peaked snot volcanoes. My job included keeping the glass cases clean. I am not permitted to haggle, I pointed out. Pfft, the mother, obviously used to getting her way, was exasperated. She had to do math. Nobody likes math. I took the items and tallied up the prices while the silent husband thumbed through bills. $11.50, I said. I increased the price by $1, just because I could, and because I was going to have to clean up a pair of snot streaks left behind by the Friendship League of Minnesota. The man paid what I asked. I bagged my first sale. Then the man with the purse asked, "Is this Ealing?" I know, a lot of people just can't believe they've finally arrived when they get to Ealing, I said. But this is it.
This is it,
the man said. He pulled a small, glossy guidebook from his purse and continued.
Ealing, Iowa. 7 unsolved decapitations in 1969.
He proudly held his book up so I could see the cover. It read, Serial Killer America.
We're on a road trip,
the man with the purse twittered like a gleeful bird. The twins snarfled and snotted against the glass.
Cross another one off the list, the mother decided. Then she added, Please be careful with my corn cobs.
I needed a cigarette. The boy in the glass. I stood outside in the parking lot and smoked. I watched the traffic of people who came and went, and came and went at the Pancake House, the Laundrette, Tipsy Cricket Liquors, and across the street at Satan's Pizza, too. At 12:45, I phoned Robbie. I lit another cigarette. I was in charge. Robbie was impressed, maybe jealous, that I was alone and having a cigarette without him. He was still in his bed when I called. I heard him light one up over the phone as we talked. So Robbie and I had a cigarette together by cell phone. It's good to have a cigarette with your best friend. I told him everything that happened, the history of the morning, even about the snot-faced twin kids from Minneapolis who smeared up the glass case, and how I overcharged them $1 just because I didn't like them. He asked if I'd gone back into the alley at Grasshopper Jungle. I said no, I wasn't going to go back there. Everything seemed okay. It was just another Saturday afternoon in Ealing, Iowa. But I couldn't shake the feeling that something impossibly huge had happened in the past 24 hours. Maybe that's just the omniscience of the recorder, who looks back on history as he's painting the walls of his cave. Shit like that. There is a blissful haze that quietly flies into your head like a swarm of anesthetized butterflies after you smoke a couple fags. Buzzing from nicotine, I went back inside From Attic to Cellar consignment store, wandered my way along the parade route of Johnny McKeon's display maze, and found myself standing once again in front of Johnny's locked office door. Johnny McKeon obviously didn't really care to hide the things he kept inside his office. Maybe they were an embarrassment. Maybe he just didn't know what to do with the things that once belonged to his dead brother. I thought I might ask Johnny about that if he ever showed me his experiments. I wanted to know why. As my fingers felt along the groove of the molding, I thought about what I would do with Eric's things if he never came home again.
I would probably keep them in my room and not let anyone else look at them. I understood Johnny McKeon. The key was still there, where Johnny always hid it. I went inside his office. Johnny McKeon did not say anything about the missing globe to the policeman who came out that morning. If he had, he'd have to have shown them the rest of the things inside the office. Johnny would not want to do that. There were smears on the old library shelf where Tyler's fingers had tracked through the dust at the base of the globe. He didn't even bother to take the stand. It was still there, still announcing the contained MI plague strain 412E. Not so much contained any longer. That was the first time I'd considered the possibility that maybe those four boys were going to end up getting sick. But I figured all that shit was from 1969, according to the dates on the labels. Nothing incurable could ever come from 1969. The Beatles and the Stones came from 1969. And like Johnny McKeon said, it was only photoluminescent mold after all. The two-headed boy, although hardly bigger than a cantaloupe, was older than me. I talked to him. You're nearing middle age, my man. You must be tired of being inside that jar. I put my face close to the glass, resting my chin on the shelf so I could look directly into the little dark sockets of the boy's eyes. I placed my palm on the cool curve of the glass. The boy inside twitched. The movement was so slight, just a jittering spasm of the fingers, but I saw it. I snapped my hand away from the glass and took a step back. I bumped into Johnny McKeon's desk so hard it felt like I ripped a hole in my jeans. Skating and kayaking. The alleyway behind Satan's Pizza wasn't nearly as long or accommodating for skaters as Grasshopper Jungle. The pizza place was a standalone business, so all we could really do there was goof around in small circles. Goofing around in small circles was how Robbie and I usually skated anyway. When I showed up, Robbie had on the grimacing lemur mask and the Titus Andronicus t-shirt I loaned him the night before. After what happened to me in Johnny McKeon's office, everything I saw that day seemed like it oozed out of some twisted nightmare. I kept telling myself that maybe I was only imagining things as a result of too much nicotine and too little oxygen in my brain. There was no way that little boy could have moved his fingers at me. "Hey-ho, lemur boy," I said. Robbie raised his arms, twisting his fingers into claws above his hairy lemur head. He froze there like that, not saying anything. He stood with one foot on the deck of his skateboard. My board was right beside his. Grimacing lemurs are a little unnerving. "Amazingly lifelike," I said. Robbie remained silent and motionless, a taxidermist's display of a lemur-Lutheran boy crossbreed experiment. I shrugged and slid my skateboard away from him. I got on it and pushed off.
"Hey, wait up,"
Robbie said. He followed after me. When he rolled up alongside me, still wearing the mask, Robbie said,
"I went through the jungle, porcupine."
"Did you see anything?" I asked.
"Nah,"
Robbie said.
"Somebody pushed the dumpster back. Everything was just like it's always been."
"Are the pubic lice happy and well?" I asked.
"Thriving,"
Robbie said.
"I picked up a few hitchhikers who wanted to hang out with you. Let's have a fag."
"Okay. Can you smoke in that thing?"
"I haven't tried yet," Robbie answered. "It's probably not flame retardant. Or else it's carcinogenic. Or we'll mess up your sperm and make you have two-headed babies and shit."
"Yeah," I agreed. "You wouldn't want to smoke cigarettes wearing a carcinogenic grimacing lemur mask that's capable of messing up your sperm."
"Nobody wants messed up sperm."
"Messed up sperm is the evolutionary slot machine that will destroy mankind." Robbie and I were having a conversation about sperm. Robbie said,
"How long are we going to talk about sperm?"
I answered, "I don't know. Talking about sperm is something that people just don't do enough of. It does make me feel a little weird, though." Robbie took off the mask. His face was pink and damp with sweat. We looked at each other. Robbie smiled and nodded. I knew everything between us was okay. He stuck his hand out, and I took it. It was a real Lutheran minister kind of awkward and sweaty Iowa handshake.
"What is this shit?" I said. "We are shaking hands. We never shake hands."
Robbie said,
"I know. Well, I just, wanted to tell you."
"You don't need to say anything, Rob." I patted his shoulder.
"I guess not," Robbie said.
I took out one of the packs of cigarettes Ollie Jungfrau sold me, and Robbie added,
"I think it is always appropriate to end a conversation about sperm with a sweaty handshake."
"Yeah," I said. We sat down on our skateboards right next to each other and smoked. Every Saturday, Robbie asked me how many donuts Olli Jungfrau ate. I could not be certain, but that day I think I counted 9. Robbie asked me to swear I would take pictures with my cell phone if Olli Jungfrau ever exploded. Then I told Robbie about going back inside Johnny McKeon's office, and how scared I was because I believed I saw the two-headed boy inside the jar twitch his fingers at me when I talked to him. Robbie shook his head dismissively.
Last night, after all the shit that happened, we are both probably traumatized. You were seeing things.
I don't think I'm traumatized, Robbie, I said.
I think the inside of this lemur mask made my face stink, Robbie said.
He blew out a big gaseous cloud of smoke. You're still wearing the t-shirt I loaned you, I said.
I'll give it back after I wash it.
Oh, sure thing, Rob, I asked. How's the flamingo?
Fine, just fine.
Robbie rocked sideways on his board.
On Monday night, my mom's working a double shift. You should come over and get drunk with me.
Maybe we should do that, I said. I was thinking. Have you ever popped one of your mom's little blue relaxers?
Zannies? Robbie asked.
Yeah, ever taken one? I said, I was just wondering. They look like little boats, don't they? Kayaks. I just figured they make you all calm and shit. Sailing away. Like you don't have any problems and everything is figured out.
Robbie said, I never tried one. Anyway, you don't have any problems, or anything to figure out either.
Sure I don't, I said.
Like what?
Robbie asked. Okay, I said. Okay, at times, can effectively serve as the closing curtain to difficult teenage conversations. Then I said, I will come over on Monday and get drunk with you.
I'll let you wear the lemur mask.
I don't want my face to stink.
Yeah, probably not.
By the time we'd gotten on to our second cigarette, I worked up the nerve to tell Robbie about the date I made with Shan. Feeling awkward and guilty about it was stupid, too, but it was just another element of my confusion about things. Robbie didn't seem to mind. I was more confused. I thought he'd feel left out, like we were ditching him. He offered to drive me to Shan's house so I wouldn't have to skate all the way there. Robbie said it would give me B.O., and I probably did not want to have B.O. on a date with Shan. You're right, I said. I don't want to have B.O. Robbie said,
if you have B.O., you might as well have messed up sperm, too.
I'll shake to that, I said. Robbie picked up the grimacing lemur mask and sniffed the inside of it.
This is nasty, he said.
I thought you'd be disappointed, I said, because we're going out on Saturday night without you.
But it's Shan, Robbie said. She's your girlfriend. You need to go out together. That's what boyfriends and girlfriends do.
Yeah, well, I feel bad.
Why?
I said, I don't really know, Robbie. What are you going to do tonight?
Robbie said, me? Laundry, I guess. Shit like that.
Right.
Come on, Robbie said. Let's head out and pick up the Explorer.
Maybe tomorrow we could do something, I said. Just me and you.
We could fold my laundry, Robbie offered.
Eden 5 needs you. Shan Collins and I ate burgers and onion rings at Jackie's Country Kitchen in Waterloo, Iowa after the movie. People in Iowa are real dynamos at naming businesses. Movies came to Waterloo about a month after they began showing on other parts of the continent. The movie Shan and I sat through was one that all the kids at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy had seen on opening day, which happened weeks earlier, just so they could tell everyone who hadn't seen it what it was about and how good it was. The kids at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy all agreed the movie was terrific. It was probably the dumbest movie I'd ever seen in my life. But since I was with Shan, I didn't actually pay attention to much of it. It is difficult for any movie to keep my attention. That's something else wrong with me, I think. It's all part of the big confusing history behind Austin Unze Serba. I don't know why I am the way I am. I knew I should talk to my father about things. I just needed to find a way to get that conversation to start. Shan and I sat in the corner of the back row. The movie was called Eden 5 Needs You 4. I had not seen the first three parts, but it didn't matter since everyone at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy had, and had told me everything about what happened. It also didn't matter because apparently the plot of the movie was not an essential element to the experience. Eden 5 Needs You 4 was a very loud, visually assaulting science fiction movie about a teenager who was abducted by benevolent aliens and taken to a planet called Eden 5. The first four Edens were probably shitholes. The benevolent aliens abducted the teen because Earth was dying,
due to all the wars and environmental destruction humans had inflicted on their planet and shit like that. So the benevolent aliens chose the teen because they wanted his sperm to start a new population of human beings on this other, nice planet called Eden 5. Well, the teen didn't want his sperm to be the sole genesis of a new race of mankind on Eden 5, because he did not want to be responsible for all the shitty things human beings are genetically driven to do. War, crucifixions, genocide, religion, television. He paid attention to history enough to know that Adam should have used a condom. So the teen stole one of the benevolent alien spacecrafts and returned to Earth to get his best friend, another teen, so he could go back to Eden 5 with him, and both of their sperm could be used to start a new race of mankind. That way, neither one of them would have to take full responsibility for all the shit human beings are naturally driven to do. You know, friends blaming friends for the other guy's sperm being messed up. That's what history's all about. In the meantime, the President of the United States, who had formerly been director of the Central Intelligence Agency, learned of the plan to start a new world on Eden 5. The president was unhappy that it was not going to be his sperm that started an entire new race. He ordered the United States Space Agency to send rockets up and destroy the craft with, now, the two teenagers aboard. The United States spaceships were also loaded with frozen embryos that had all been created from the president's sperm. The United States spacecrafts also looked like gigantic flying pairs of balls. Hollywood is good at subtlety. Like I said, it was the dumbest movie I ever saw. The actor who played the teenager was 30 years old in real life, but nobody in the paying audience seemed to mind because he was very handsome and well-groomed. I don't really know how the movie ended, or if there was a clear conclusion to the story. While we waited in line for our tickets, I did hear some boys ahead of us talking about next summer's release of Eden 5 Needs You 5, so the movie probably had a real cliffhanger of an ending. The boys in front of us chewed tobacco. They carried paper coffee cups that were halfway filled with sticky brown saliva. They left these on the floor of the theater, for the future. If you were ever going to start a new planet and needed some sperm, these boys would not be on your list. During the big in-space fight scene between the flying American testicles and the teens whose sperm was going to create a new race of blameless humans, Shan and I had our tongues in each other's mouths. It's not that the movie made us particularly horny. If we actually paid attention to it, we might likely have been anesthetized. I read a popular myth somewhere about how schools in Iowa used to put a chemical called saltpeter in their cafeteria food. People believed that saltpeter made it so boys would not get erections. It was all a bunch of shit, of course. Nothing, except possibly paying attention to Eden 5 Needs You 4, could ever make boys not get erections. I slid my hand up inside the loose sweater Shan was wearing and played with her perfect breasts. The movie was very loud. I had never touched Shan's naked breasts before. She liked it. I liked it more, I think. In fact, Shan dropped her hand between my legs and rubbed me. Shan had never put her hand there before. This caused a very sudden and accidental eruption of Mount Austin Unze Serba inside my jeans. I gasped and gulped. It happened exactly at a moment where the dumb movie went absolutely quiet. I was mortified. I nearly passed out. Shan knew what happened. It was obvious. The tobacco-chewing yahoos in front of us could probably tell what happened. I slumped down in my seat. I wondered if it was possible to die from embarrassment.
Oh,
Shan said. I said. And Shan whispered,
Eden 5 needs you.
So, while we eyed each other over our burgers and onion rings, I slipped my foot out of my shoe and caressed Shan's leg with my toes under the table at Jackie's Country Kitchen. I was somewhere in the middle of telling her the story about Olli Jungfrau's uncle's German shepherd that can toast a brownie on demand, and how damaged sperm was probably responsible for every great man-made calamity in history, when Shan said to me,
You know what I really love about you, Austin?
I did not know what she really loved about me. Probably not my endurance. I said, No, tell me. Shan said,
I love how you tell stories. I love how, whenever you tell me a story, you go backwards and forwards and tell me everything else that could possibly be happening in every direction, like an explosion, like a flower blooming.
Really? I asked. I never noticed that about me before. I felt myself getting embarrassed again, but not nearly to the degree I had been when we encountered an accidental spill during the painfully quiet post-epic battle scene in Eden 5 Needs You 4. Shan said,
I think you're irresistibly cute, Austin Zerba.
Thank you, Shannon Collins, I said. I will shake to that. Here is what happened that night. 7 people in Ealing, Iowa stopped eating food. They began bumping into walls and shit. They were very sick. Ollie Jungfrau was constipated. He'd eaten too many donuts that day and had a dinner whose principal ingredient was cheese. There were only 6 houses on the street where I lived. 2 of them had been repossessed by the bank. Their windows and doors were posted with notices printed in very small type. At exactly the same moment Eden 5 Needs You 4 got embarrassingly silent and I erupted, a 3rd home on my street went empty as the owners were ordered out by grim-faced officers of the court who waved official papers. And in that house, tucked away inside the drawer of an abandoned nightstand, were 4 unopened condoms and a Book of Mormon that had been taken from a room at a Marriott hotel in San Diego, California. The family had been to SeaWorld. Pastor Roland Duff ate a personal-sized Stan Preem pizza at Satan's Pizza. While he sat alone, Roland Duff read the Waterloo paper and looked up movie listings. He thought he might enjoy seeing Eden 5 Needs You 4. Pastor Roland Duff had never seen the Pacific Ocean. Shan's stepfather, Johnny McKeon, who was also my employer, drove out to Waterloo to pick us up at Jackie's Country Kitchen at 10:30. On the drive back to Ealing, Shan sat next to me with her head resting on my shoulder. It was a quiet ride. Most of the way home, I was trying to decide if what happened to me could technically be considered having sex, if that was the first time I actually had sex with someone else. I decided it was close enough to repopulate Eden 5, close enough to be a forbidden subject in the library at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Thinking about what happened in the movie theater made me hope Shan would touch me like that again. I also desperately wanted to change out of my soggy Iowa plaid boxers.
So, how was the movie? Johnny asked.
Huh? I said. Sweaty, damp, and oddly energized, I got home at 11:15. My predictable parents were already asleep at that time. The house was dark. Ingrid waggled and quivered excitedly. She stuck her bowling pin nose into my crotch when I opened the door. Go toast some brownies, Ingrid, I said. I stood on our front step and waited for Ingrid to shit. Then we both went upstairs into my room, where at last I could peel myself out of my ruined clothes. At 12:04, I slipped between the coolness of my sheets just as my phone rang. I thought it was Robbie, but it was Shan. She told me the typing ticking sound had come back and she was scared. Tomorrow, after church, me and Robbie are coming over, I said. We're going to find out what's inside the wall.
Okay, Shan said. I love you, Austin.
Eden 5 needs me, I said. I was very horny again. An awful lot of math. Wendy McKeon looked so much like her daughter, Shan, that people sometimes assumed they might be sisters. Robbie and I went directly to Shan's house after church. Johnny and Wendy didn't take Shan to services that week. They made the excuse that they were settling into their new old house. When you didn't go to church in Ealing, sometimes it was almost necessary to stick a sign in your yard asking forgiveness from your neighbors. God cuts slack to people who need to settle in, but your neighbors might not. Students from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy were required to wear our ties and sweaters at church, even though most people in Ealing did not dress up on Sundays.
Don't you two look handsome,
Wendy McKeon said when she greeted us at her door. Robbie and I hadn't changed into our non-Lutheran boy clothes yet. Like candy canes, I said.
Kind of makes you want to beat us up, doesn't it? Robbie asked. Oh, you,
Wendy said and put her hand flat on Robbie's chest. Robbie was so much funnier and better looking than I was. I believed Wendy sometimes wondered why Shan wasn't his girlfriend, instead of the Polish kids. Robbie wasn't out to anyone but me and Shan. Wendy McKeon didn't know anything about teenage boys unless she learned it from one of those daytime television talk programs. Wendy McKeon would have thought it was not normal for Robbie and me to experiment. There was an exterminator service van parked in front of the McKeon house. Shan had told her mother about the noises coming from the wall, and Johnny and Wendy decided it was most likely rats. Old houses like this do often have rats inside them, I said to Shan when Robbie and I were in her room. I couldn't help but play with the idea of asking Shan for an Eden 5 Needs You 4 threesome with me and Robbie. The amount of math in that thought made my head ache.
Rats with typewriters, Robbie added. These rats type every 6 hours, Shan said,
continuing the numerical assault on my head.
At exactly 6 and 12. I've been keeping track.
So they're obsessive compulsive rats with typewriters, Robbie said.
Just wait a moment, Shan said.
She looked at her wristwatch. It was 11:50. I was horny and mathematically confused. The exterminator men crawled all around the floor, looking for holes rats could use to get inside the walls. When they didn't find any, they crawled up into the attic and around the perimeter of the home's foundation, setting traps and putting out attractive dishes of poison that looked like candy corn. They did not find any rats because there weren't any. At exactly noon, the noise inside Shan's wall came again. This time, all three of us were there, and all three of us heard it. The sound went silent in less than a minute, but we triangulated with our ears the precise spot on the wall where it originated.
"Do you kids want some lunch?"
Wendy called from deep in the house somewhere. I nodded at Shan and she yelled back at her mother. The house was so big it wouldn't have been too outrageous to actually use cell phones. In houses, teenagers tend to communicate with their parents by screaming across distances. "It's some kind of a machine," I said. The wall there was made from top to bottom tongue and groove wood plank. Some of the slats were loose and could wiggle. I felt certain we'd be able to pry a board or two up without inflicting any permanent damage to Shan's bedroom wall. I asked Shan to bring us some butter knives or flathead screwdrivers, anything Robbie and I could use to get at the boards. And just when Wendy McKeon hollered up to us that lunch was served, Robbie and I peeled back a 6-inch wide slat and found the source of Shan's 4 times per day haunting. The ghost in Shan's wall was a machine. The thing was set back between the wall of Shan's room and a bathroom on the other side. It sat on a low, dust-covered pine shelf. Thick rubberized wires ran from its back, following the roadways of wall studs and joists up and down, out of sight. The machine was also covered in dust, made of bakelite and blue rounded metal that had the same aesthetic style of a toaster or an automobile designed 50 years ago. At the front was a keyboard, like a typewriter's, but the thing was much bigger than a simple typewriter. This was what was called a teletype machine. From the back of the platen cylinder, a yellowed scroll of perforated paper had been spitting out the same repeated message, typed out in black ink capital letters that formed ladder-like rungs over several feet. "The flamingo alerts on environmental presence of 412E. Silo generators now activated. Report to the silo with proper haste." "The flamingo alerts on environmental presence of 412E. Silo generators now activated. Report to the silo with proper haste." "The flamingo alerts on environmental presence of 412E. Silo generators now activated. Report to the silo with proper haste." I looked at Robbie. He looked at me. Both of us at the same time said, "Oh." And Robbie said,
"Nobody says with proper haste."
"Who would ever say something like that?" I added. Shan said,
"What's going on, Austin?"
I said, "Tally-ho. I don't think I'll need to eat again before Guy Fawkes Day," I said.
"Tally-ho to that," Robbie said.
"Chip-chip and all that," I said. That night, Robbie drove his car east along the flat, straight highway that linked Ealing to Waterloo. We were hanging out together like I'd promised. Robbie said we would be traveling through time, and it might be ugly. I did not know why Robbie wanted to go to Waterloo, or why he wanted to travel through time. I only hoped he did not want to sit through Eden 5 Needs You 4. Wendy McKeon was raised in southern Indiana. Regionalists sometimes refer to that area as northern Kentucky. Lunch, for a person raised in that part of the continent, consisted of the following: fried chicken, potato salad, mashed potatoes, creamed corn, deviled eggs, canned fruit cocktail, sweet pickles, American cheese slices, white bread, softened margarine, milk, cake, and peanut butter. After the orgy of Wendy McKeon's lunch, we unplugged the teletype machine before we left. Robbie and I took the printout of the repeating message with us, and we replaced the wobbly board to the wall in Shan's bedroom. "Having a teletype machine built into your wall was not so strange," I offered, considering Shan's room also included a door that went nowhere and a staircase descending to a dungeon for horny Lutheran boys. Shan agreed. It was just a weird house.
"But it is on the Ealing Registry of Historical Homes," Robbie reminded us.
"An abundance of distressed bricks," I commented.
"Who knows what other crazy stuff the McKeons did in this house?" Shan said.
"Yes," I said. "Who knows?" There was some figuring out that had to be done. Figuring out meant a sort of confession to Shan would be involved if Robbie and I were not careful. I did not want to tell Shan about the things that happened in Johnny McKeon's office, and I did not want to say to her what Robbie and I did when we were up on the roof of the Ealing Mall. But I do not lie. If Shan ever asked about it, I would tell her. So Robbie and I opted for a waiting period of quiet consideration before exploring the possibilities of what the teletype message actually could mean. Robbie and I went back to my house and changed out of our Lutheran boy superhero costumes. I loaned him another Austin Zerba outfit from my closet. Soon, I thought, all my clothes as well as Robbie's would be scattered, unwashed, over the backseat of his Ford Explorer. There is no silo at the McKeon house, I said. I looked. I pulled on a pair of jeans and slipped my feet into some loose skate shoes.
So did I, Robbie said.
I gave him some Levi's and my Pink Floyd t-shirt to wear. Mine said LCD sound system. You're not planning on taking me to see Eden 5 Needs You 4, are you?
No, Robbie answered. I'm going to see something I always wondered about, but was too chicken to go by myself.
Sounds like what I'd say about Eden 5, I said. Eventually, I was relieved. I was grateful that Robbie truly was not interested in the film I'd seen with Shan the night before. Robbie didn't even slow the car when we drove past the Waterloo Cinezar. Another brilliant job of name branding by an Iowa entrepreneur. Finally, Robbie pulled the Explorer into the parking lot of a squat and dim strip mall. The place was dismal, but not nearly as run down and left in abandon as the Ealing Mall at Grasshopper Jungle. The signs above each of the businesses were lit up, despite the fact that the majority of places were closed on Sunday nights. There was a laundrette, and it appeared to be clean and condom-free. Naturally, there was a liquor store, another business called Cheap Smokes, that had a decal of a marijuana leaf in the corner of its front window, a barbershop, and an indoor shooting range and gun shop called Fire at Will's. Waterloo was definitely the place. And at the end of the mall, in an area where four or five cars had parked beneath a lonely overhead light facing the unit's front door, was a bar called the Tally Ho. The Tally Ho was widely known in the area as being a secret place for homosexual men to hang out and meet. The secret was not well kept. People in Ealing just didn't talk about the Tally Ho, or if they did, it was in a very low register, so other ears would not perk up at mention of the name. The Tally Ho was Waterloo, Iowa's one and only gay bar. I said.
What? Said Robbie.
Why did you come to the Tally Ho, Robbie?
I wanted to see what it looked like,
Robbie explained. We can't go inside, I argued. People might think we're, prostitutes or something.
Did you actually just say prostitute? Robbie asked.
I can't be certain, I said. I think I did.
We can't go inside because we're only 16, Robbie said.
Do you want to go inside? I asked.
Are you asking me on a date, Austin?
Robbie said.
No.
I was so confused. Robbie went on.
I wanted to come here just so I could see what the future is like. What if I end up here with nowhere else to go? What will I look like?
You could wear the grimacing lemur mask, I offered.
I always wondered who came to this place, Robbie said.
I guess everyone kind of wonders that, but they're just too afraid to admit it, I said. Robbie shook out some cigarettes, held the pack so I could take one. I pressed the lighter into the dash. I thought I knew why Robbie came here. It was sad. We smoked.
Do you want to go look? Robbie said.
What? Like inside?
No. Maybe we could just poke our faces in the door and say something like, we're lost and need to know how to get back to Ealing.
Nobody would believe it, I said. Nobody ever wants to get back to Ealing.
You may be right, Robbie said. Still, what would they do to us?
What if they think we're gay or something?
What are you trying to say, Austin?
Sorry, Rob. I took a drag off my cigarette. I guess I better just shut up. Robbie got out of the car. Robbie wasn't angry or upset at what I'd said. Real friends know what they mean when one of them says clumsy or stupid things. History shows that. History also shows there aren't an awful lot of real friends on the record. So I got out of the car, too. The Inner Tomb. It was frightening and thrilling, following Robbie to the door of the Tally Ho. It seemed as though hidden eyes were out there in the dark of the parking lot, and they were watching us and constructing stories, histories, about what these two boys from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy might be up to. The Tally Ho, as it turned out, was not a vibrant happening scene at all. It was exactly what Robbie expected. He stood with his hand on the door's pull bar. A sign hung from the metal S-hooks beneath clear plastic suction cups on the inside of the glass. It said, "No persons under 21 allowed." I expected to hear happy music seeping out from the front door, the sound of laughter and boisterous barroom conversations. But the tally-ho let no such atmosphere leak out from its small, encapsulated world. The place was as quiet as a cemetery in a morning snowfall. Robbie took a deep breath, pulled open the door, and stepped inside. And, like a sedated chihuahua on a jeweled leash, I followed him. I was so nervous I thought my knees would buckle. My head swam in agitated seas of conflict and confusion. What if people thought we were gay? Why did I care what people thought? What if I really was gay? I kissed Robbie, after all. What would Shan say about us being here? What if someone started hitting on me or Robbie? What if we got in trouble for walking into the place? What if we got beat up again by some assholes like Grant Wallace and his friends? Robbie Breeze was much braver than I could ever be. We stood there, dumb and quiet in the dark alcove just inside the front door of the tally-ho. The place was as tired and mournful as the library at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy after the masturbation scandal. Nobody so much as turned to glance at the two nervous kids who stood at the door. I hid behind Robbie. The bartender washed glasses. He wore a t-shirt that was too tight. It accentuated the roll of his belly. He was balding and showed a blurring tattoo of Betty Page, blanketed beneath the swirling shrubbery of black hair on his forearm. Two other men sat at the bar. They both appeared to be tired, in their 40s. They stared straight ahead as though watching something other than their own reflections in the mirror behind the bartender. They were separated by three bar stools. The closer of the two had dirty hands. He bit his fingernails, too. At the back of the room sat an undersized pool table with worn felt. It was tucked too near a corner to actually be playable. A man with a Royals ball cap shot pool by himself. He scratched the cue ball while we watched him. After he took another shot, he glanced up at me and Robbie. He smiled. I whispered, "Aren't you going to ask them? You know, say we're lost or shit?" Robbie shook his head and backed himself into me. He said, "No, let's get out of here, Austin." Robbie leaned on me, pushing me back. We quietly slid out the door. Nobody even watched us leave. And here's number 5. Robbie and I sat against the tailgate of the Explorer. We smoked cigarettes and watched cars on the highway. Robbie said he wished we'd have brought our skateboards with us. "Skating would be good," I said. The alley behind Tally Ho looked like a real clean place to skate. "I never knew there were 4 gay guys in Waterloo," I said. That number involved making an assumption about the bartender.
"It's Sunday," Robbie said. "I bet when this place gets really busy, there might be 5 or 6.
"You're not going to be like that, Rob," I said. "I mean, all lonely and shit."
"Is that what you think?" Robbie asked.
"I'm pretty sure that is what I think," I said. Out on the highway, a car slowed and then pulled into the parking lot at the opposite end, near Fire at Will's indoor shooting range. It was a newer Honda Accord. The car drove along the front aisle of parking stalls and then turned left into a slot beside the other vehicles lined up near the tally-ho. Robbie and I watched from our hidden spot behind his old Ford. "And here's number 5, I said. The Honda's door opened. Freshly pressed slacks and shiny black loafers with dangly tassels that flapped from their insteps like beagle ears lowered mechanically from the bottom of the driver's door. Then Pastor Roland Duff got out, straightened, and brushed off his trousers, shut the door, and entered the tally-ho. I said. Robbie answered. "I wonder what Pastor Roland Duff is doing here," I said.
"Do you really wonder?" Robbie asked.
"I guess not," I said.
"He must be lonely," Robbie said.
"I'll buy that, Robbie," I said. "But if Pastor Roland Duff is lonely, it isn't because he's gay. It's because he's a shit spoon." Robbie nodded thoughtfully and smoked. Then he said,
"I'll buy that too, Austin."
"I would like another cigarette, Robbie," I said. Robbie pulled the crumpled pack from his back pocket and handed it to me. He said,
"Where did you get that word from? I admire it."
"What?" I said. "Shitspoon?"
"Uh-huh,"
Robbie said. "It was the name of the alien spacecraft in Eden 5 Needs You 4, I said.
"You're making that up,"
Robbie said.
"I know.
I didn't pay attention to that shitspoon flick at all, Rob." Taking drags. "Were you scared in there?" I asked.
"I wasn't scared," Robbie said.
"I was," I said.
"I could feel your heartbeat through the floorboards. I thought it was because you found the bartender to be attractive."
Was he attractive? I asked.
Kind of,
Robbie said. I smoked. Do you think I'm queer, Rob? I asked.
I don't care if you're queer,
Robbie said.
Queer is just a word, like orange. I know who you are. There's no one word for that.
I believed him. I know I'm not orange, I said.
Kind of oatmeal-y, Robbie said.
I always let Robbie read the books. He was the only one allowed inside Austin Unze Serba's history department. Sometimes I'm confused, I said. Actually, pretty much all the time I am. I wonder if I'm normal. I think I might ask my dad about it. You know, if he ever felt this way. Or if maybe he still does sometimes. Because I feel, I wonder if I'm queer or shit.
You should ask your dad, Porcupine,
Robbie said. Would you ask your dad?
My dad doesn't give a shit about me,
Robbie said. I took another drag. It made me feel weird, the other night. But I keep thinking about you, and I think doing that means there is something wrong about me.
I'm sorry. I won't do what I did ever again. You know. Sorry, Austin.
Nah, I said. It's not something to be sorry about. I just don't know what to do, Rob.
You worry too much, Robbie said.
I know. And then Robbie said,
I do love you, though.
Yeah, Rob, I know. I blew out a cloud of smoke. I tried to make it all perfect and cool like Robbie could, but it didn't work. So I said, I love you, Robbie. I did not say two. Robbie said,
I know that, Austin. It is nice to hear you say it, though.
I wish we brought our skateboards.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what to do. A visitor comes and goes. So we stood there and smoked our cigarettes down. In the paralytic coma that is a Sunday night in a strip mall parking lot paved atop the scraps of a cornfield somewhere imprecisely located on the outskirts of Waterloo, Iowa, the whooshing excitement of passing cars came once or twice, every 5 minutes or so. And that was our day. You know what I mean. The tally-ho turned out to be not so much a disappointment for Robbie as the sad realization of everything he expected to see. That is, except for Pastor Roland Duff showing up. But history does consistently prove that whenever guys go out to visit someplace they've never been before, they're going to see shit they did not expect to see. The age of discovery had come to Ealing, Iowa. Experiments and shit like that. Kreese Sterba never expected to see the frosted cupcake breasts on Eva Nightingale's pillowed mounds of peach ice cream body. He never thought he would see his father, who was also named Unze, slipping down into the cold, green-black Atlantic with nothing more than a silver chain for St. Casimir jingling upon the Quaker Oats whiteness of his still and empty chest. And as strange and discomforting as it was to watch the headmaster from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy pull up in freshly pressed attire and then casually step inside the tally-ho with the carriage of a man entering the most familiar place on his planet, what we saw next was even stranger. Out from the darkness in back of us, loaded down with plastic bags, bundles of clothing, suitcases, and a cardboard box lashed by three bungee cords to a broken saddlebag frame that vibrated over a half-flat back tire, a squeaking and tottering rusted old bicycle wobbled and creaked its way into the lamplight. Hungry Jack had come to pay a visit. Hungry Jack got around for an old guy on a crooked bicycle. He's a real dynamo on the two-wheeler, I observed.
I don't think he's a tally-ho kind of guy,
Robbie said. You never know, I offered. Robbie took another puff and shook his head.
You never do, Porcupine.
It was Robbie who had spoken to Hungry Jack in the past. I was afraid of the toothless old war criminal. Robbie was much braver than I was, except when it came to shit like breaking into From Attic to Cellar consignment store in the middle of the night. Robbie had given Hungry Jack cigarettes in the past, and, on occasion, the two of them smoked together in Grasshopper Jungle while I worked inside Johnny McKeon's store. That was how Robbie found out all the history about Hungry Jack and the things he'd done in Vietnam.
You want to know what happens? Hungry Jack had said to Robbie.
What happens? Robbie said.
Hungry Jack said,
you could do whatever you wanted to do over there.
What I would want to do was get on a boat and come home, Robbie told him.
No boats!
Hungry Jack jumped up and down and repeated himself.
No boats! No fucking boats home! What are you, a crybaby?
I suppose I am a crybaby,
Robbie said to him.
You could do whatever you want, Hungry Jack said. Any kind of drug you like. Heroin. Pot. Heroin. Heroin. You could fuck anything you wanted. All the time. drugs and fucks. I'd bet you'd like to fuck anything, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you?
Robbie told him. I don't think I would like to fuck anything.
Yes, you would fuck anything, Hungry Jack told him.
No, I wouldn't, Robbie affirmed.
You would too, Hungry Jack argued.
Robbie told me this back-and-forth rally of countershot verbal tennis balls continued for several rounds.
Well, that's what we did, Hungry Jack said. Fucked everything. Fucked everyone who'd hold still long enough. We fucked the planet if we wanted to. And no boats. But you know what happened?
Suppose you cooked your brain on dope and a little while later your penis scabbed up and fell off from all the dirty shit you fucked, Robbie ventured.
As soon as one boy shoots, everyone starts shooting, Hungry Jack told Robbie.
And then Hungry Jack said,
then it's time to come home.
Then Hungry Jack told Robbie about all the people who died in the village.
Robbie told me. But I never talked to Hungry Jack before or since that day Robbie told me the old man's stories. So that night, Robbie Breeze and I stood there in the parking lot of the Tally Ho, which was Waterloo, Iowa's one and only gay bar. I thought about fucking things. And while I thought about fucking things, and Robbie and I smoked cigarettes, we witnessed firsthand what happens to a person who swallowed a mouthful of Stan Preem pizza that had been contaminated by contained MI plague strain 412E. Here is what happened. Hungry Jack tottered toward us. The front tire of his bicycle jerked this way and that, but somehow the man kept rolling. Hungry Jack's eyes were fixed directly on Robbie and me. When he stopped his bicycle, Hungry Jack was 10 feet away from us. He stood at the edge of the dark near a low easement that separated the blacktop of the parking lot from the blacktop of the highway. At first, the old man was motionless, straddling the top tube of the bike frame with his feet planted on either side. Hungry Jack's chin was slick with drool, but that wasn't uncommon for him. Hungry Jack had no front teeth. He stared at Robbie. Hungry Jack knew Robbie. For all I could tell, I was invisible to the man. Robbie took a big drag from his cigarette. Robbie said,
hey, Jack, you want a cigarette?
Jack stared and drooled.
He's freaking out on you, Rob, I whispered. Let's just leave.
Maybe he's exhausted from the long ride, Robbie said. Then he asked again, want to smoke, Jack?
Hungry Jack wobbled. He raised his right knee and got off the bicycle. Hungry Jack released his grasp on the handlebars and his bicycle crashed in a noisy heap. A thermos bottle with a small amount of gasoline in it rolled away toward the curb. Robbie smoked. Hungry Jack looked at Robbie. He took 2 steps toward us and stopped. The whole time, I never saw the man blink once. He also never said anything to Robbie. Then Hungry Jack turned around and stepped over the low hedge that bordered the parking lot. He lumbered like a sleepwalker, out onto the highway. Hungry Jack walked directly into the path of a Dodge pickup that was speeding in the direction headed away from Ealing. The truck never slowed, even after the concussive thud the old man's body made when Hungry Jack went spinning and cartwheeling down the road. Things like that happened in Iowa all the time, but Robbie and I never saw it right in front of our faces.
Holy shit, Rob, I said.
Robbie said,
holy shit!
The thing in the cornfield. Something else happened, too. We did not talk about it at school. Shan wondered why Robbie and I were both so sullen that next day. We told her we were tired. I asked if the noise in her wall had come back, but our unplugging the teletype machine had put an end to the typing rats problem in the McKeon house.
What are we going to say, Rob? I had asked him.
Are we going to tell Shan we were hanging out in the parking lot of a gay bar smoking cigarettes, and we saw Pastor Roland Duff out cruising just before some homeless guy stepped in front of a Dodge truck? Are we going to tell her what happened after that? And Robbie said,
what did happen after that, Austin? I still don't believe we saw that shit.
Because what happened was this. We ran out onto the highway to see if we could help Hungry Jack. It was terrible. It took us several minutes to find him. The truck had thrown the old man's body more than 100 feet through the air. We found Hungry Jack lying in a field of waist-high corn on the opposite side of the highway from the Tally Ho. He had been knocked completely out of his shoes, and his dirty pants had been pulled down, turned entirely inside out, and twisted around his broken legs. Hungry Jack wasn't just dead. He was destroyed. I had never seen anyone dead before. Neither had Robbie. I thought about Kreese Sherba saying goodbye to his father on the boat in the middle of the ocean, how scared and alone he must have felt. I thought about St. Casimir,
and Pastor Roland Duff across the street from us.
"Holy shit, Rob,"
I said again. I stepped closer to the mangled wreckage of the old man.
Robbie said, "Don't touch him."
"He just walked right out in front of that shit," I said.
"We need to call someone," Robbie said.
I took my phone out of my pocket and turned it on. Then Hungry Jack moved his arms. His chest heaved and collapsed, and he wriggled around in the dirt between the young corn stalks that had been mowed down when he tumbled and tumbled through the field.
"Stay still," I tried to tell him.
Robbie and I stood back, afraid to get too close. From the light on my cell phone's screen, I could see how there was blood all over the place. Pieces of Hungry Jack were sticking out from his belly and from the top of his head. But the old man wheezed and writhed around in the dirt. It looked like he was breaking apart. He was coming apart like a soft-boiled egg oozing thick, yolky blood.
"Let's get somebody," Robbie said.
My hand shook so bad I could not even punch 3 emergency digits on my phone. I also could not look away from the thrashing heap in the cornfield. Hungry Jack split entirely in half, the same way you'd cleave the husk of a roasted peanut, all the way from his skull to the fork of his crotch. Then he began turning inside out. That is exactly what happened. It wasn't that Hungry Jack was actually turning, but something was coming out of the peanut shell of the old man's body. The thing flopped and crawled stiffly, like a newborn calf, all slick and covered with blood and slippery goo.
"Holy shit,"
we both said over and over. Robbie grabbed my shoulder. I grabbed him back. We stood there, shaking and holding each other. And we watched as a 6-legged bug the size of a small man crawled like some kind of wind-up mechanized toy out of the hollowed remains of Hungry Jack. It wiped itself clean with 4 of its appendages, bringing its spiny hands up to its mandibles, licking itself clean and dry with crackling, smacking bug mouth sounds. The thing's head was triangular. It looked like a praying mantis, only it was as tall as we were. It was identical to those things, pieces of giant bugs Robbie and I had seen floating inside sealed aquarium displays in Johnny McKeon's office 2 nights before. Those things were not alive. This one was. And it came out of Hungry Jack's body. The thing hissed and moved toward us. Its head pivoted and turned in a near-complete circle. It froze the point of its chin directly at Robbie, looking, and then it backed away. I pulled Robbie's shirt so hard it nearly came off over the top of his head. We took off running. We did not look back. Part 3. The Silo. St. Casimir's real name is Casimir's. He died very young, in his 20s. Casimir's refused to be married, even though his father had arranged for a princess as the boy's bride. Because of that, Casimir's is revered for his chastity and purity. He is considered the patron saint of Poland, and also patron saint of the young. Maybe St. Casimir's was considered the patron for the young because he refused to do what his father told him to do. History shows that all teenage boys can empathize with that. But maybe Casimir's did not get married to the princess because he was confused about what he wanted and what was expected of him, just like me. Among the wonders credited to Casimir's is an account of how the young prince somehow miraculously contributed to a victory of the Polish army over the Russians. Apparently, the Russians masturbated excessively. A tough day at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. History lesson for the day. The more time you wait before telling somebody the truth about a secret you've been keeping, the longer your path out of the woods gets. "What am I going to do, Ingrid?" I said. I came straight home from school that day. I threw my Lutheran boy patriotic candy cane outfit on the floor of my bedroom and sat down at my desk. I tried to figure things out as I drew pictures and wrote my stories, but everything only became more muddled and confused. It had been a tough day at school. I did not know what to say to Robbie. I tried all day to come up with some coherent story to tell Shan. The story would have been an abbreviation, naturally, but I would have to go back to the moment Robbie and I left her alone in the back seat of his Ford Explorer on Friday night in Grasshopper Jungle. I would not tell her about experiments, or what was, and was not, normal for teenage boys to do, according to the popular psychologist who, although a middle-aged female with cosmetic lip surgery, was a foremost authority on teenage boys. I thought about how I would describe the things Robbie and I saw inside her stepfather's office, and I could only hope Shan would not ask me why I'd taken Robbie down there in the first place. Because I was not sure why Robbie and I did go down there. All I knew was that I liked doing things with Robbie that we were not supposed to do, normal or not. I curled my bare toes in Ingrid's fur. She let out a big, contented breath, like she was exhaling a billowing puff of soothing cigarette smoke. What am I going to say to Shan, Ingrid? Robbie phoned after that. He asked if I was mad at him, and I told him of course not. That was a dumb thing for him to ask. Then he said,
"Okay, Porcupine. I was just scared about it since you wouldn't talk to me at school. Can you skate down to Grasshopper Jungle? I need to show you something."
I needed a cigarette, too. So I said, "Okay, Rob, give me 15 minutes. I kicked around through my scattered wardrobe. I was running out of non-Lutheran boy clothes. I slipped on my basketball shorts. I closed my eyes and imagined a prayer to St. Casimir's to protect me against getting hit in the balls or having an erection in front of anyone. I pulled on a black Shins t-shirt, found some socks under my bed, got my skate shoes and board, and went out into the hallway. I said to Ingrid, "Don't toast any brownies till Dad lets you out." Ingrid made a dog sigh and put her chin down between her paws. Bugs do two things. And on that Monday night, Robbie Breeze and I were going to get drunk together for the first time in our lives. We had already planned it out. I had obtained permission from my mother and father to spend the night at the Del Vista Arms luxury apartments and go to school with Robbie in the morning. It was not like I could back out now. I had spent the night at the Del Vista Arms before. My father trusted Robbie. Robbie was never late to class at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Robbie never caused school-wide controversies by doing such things as reading books about Catholic boys who masturbate. Also, there was no reason for anybody to ever not trust Robbie Breeze. I trusted Robbie enough to stay at the Del Vista Arms. Two of the people who lived on Robbie's floor smoked meth. The night before, on Sunday, Robbie and I stood in a young cornfield and watched Hungry Jack's body split apart. We saw a bug the size of a small bear climb out of him. The other six victims of contained MI plague strain 412E had not hatched yet. Bugs do two things. They eat and they fuck. Bugs are soldiers, machines, just like Hungry Jack was. Bug one, the bug that hatched from Hungry Jack, wanted to eat and fuck. It ate most of what was left of Hungry Jack. It wanted to find Eileen Pope, Travis Pope's wife. It wanted to make more bugs with her. Ealing, Iowa was just like Eden 5 for a new planet of horny soldiers. Robbie was already in the alley when I got to Grasshopper Jungle. He waited for me behind Tipsy Cricket Liquors. When I skated up to him, he held an unlit cigarette in his mouth. Robbie always waited for me. It made smoking better. Lewis, the cook from the pancake house whose real name was Ah Wong Sing, had just thrown a cardboard box full of potato peelings, empty milk cartons, and eggshells into the dumpster. He spilled some peelings onto the sleeper sofa. He brushed them away with his hands.
"I wonder if he knows what pubic lice are," Robbie said.
"I have seen Lewis take a nap on that couch before," I said. Lewis smiled and nodded at us as he walked across the alleyway. Lewis did not speak English very well, so when Robbie asked me if I wanted a fag, Lewis got embarrassed. He made it obvious that he was trying not to listen to us, which made it obvious that he was listening to us. "Hello, Lewis," I said. Robbie struck a match for me and I got my cigarette going. Lewis said,
"Hello, Dynamo."
Ah Wong Sing believed that Dynamo was my real name. Lewis hung out with Ollie Jungfrau. They played online Alien Hunter games and looked at porn together. I thought maybe if I did more shit like that with Robbie, it might make me feel normal and not so confused. Lewis kept smiling nervously and disappeared through the back door to the pancake house's kitchen. We smoked.
"You're still coming over to get drunk with me, right?" Robbie said.
"I don't know about getting drunk, Rob. It's been a weird couple days. Maybe I'll just watch you do it. You know, like keep you safe and shit," I said. "Like in the 60s, guys used to do that for their buddies when they dropped acid."
"I'm not dropping acid, and I'm not going to get drunk if you don't," Robbie said.
I felt guilty about my attempt to back down. We skated through the alley without saying anything. When we were down by the dumpster, I stopped and asked Robbie what it was he wanted to show me. He carried the rolled-up front section of the Waterloo News and Gazette in his back pocket. When he unrolled it, I already had a premonition that there would be something about the accident outside Waterloo, about what had happened to Hungry Jack.
"Look at this," Robbie said.
There was a photograph of Hungry Jack's dirty and laceless shoes lying beside the highway. In the grainy background, I saw the tally-ho and fire at Will's indoor shooting range and gun shop. The photograph was like staring through a portal in time. The short article said that a transient had been struck and killed by a motorist and there were no witnesses. Transient is a nice way of saying homeless. Homeless makes people think of despair. It makes you think that the United States of America doesn't care about people. Transient sounds like you have a case of wanderlust. Wanderlust is part of the American spirit. The transient in the article had been carrying a military ID card that gave his name as Charles R. Hooford. Hungry Jack's real name was Charles R. Hooford. He was born in Indianapolis in 1950. In 1950, Harry S. Truman was president of the United States. Harry Truman, as far as I can tell, also never took a shit in his life. In 1950, the same year that a boy named Charles R. Hooford was born in Indianapolis, President Harry S. Truman sent military assistance to the French. They were trying to maintain their French Catholic colony in Vietnam. That military aid would grow and blossom to the point that a boy with wanderlust from Indiana named Charles R. Hooford ultimately took time out from fucking whatever he wanted to fuck to participate in the killing of an entire village of women, elderly people, and children. History is full of shit like that. All roads intersect on pages on my desk. All roads spring up along trails worn down by boys on bikes. All roads lead past shooting ranges, liquor stores, and gay bars. Wanderlust is part of the American spirit. The article went on to say that Charles R. Hooford's body had been brutalized by coyotes before being discovered by a farmer Monday morning. It asked anyone with information to phone the Iowa State Patrol. I said. I rolled the newspaper up and handed it back to Robbie. We never called anyone about what happened to Hungry Jack. We had been uncharacteristically silent back inside Robbie's Explorer in the lot outside the tally-ho. Robbie sped all the way home to Ealing. We smoked and smoked. I think Robbie was crying, too. Robbie and I were in shock. That is a poor excuse for someone who feels obligated to record history, but that's what happened. It was our day, and you do know what I mean. We did see the same thing, Rob. People would think we were dropping acid, I said.
Shit like that isn't supposed to happen, Robbie said.
But it did, I said. Maybe we should get drunk. Then Robbie said,
That bug,